Recorded on location at Aspen Ideas Health in Aspen, Colorado.
The National Institute of Drug Abuse is the world's largest funder of biomedical research on addiction. With a budget of nearly $2 billion, what new insights and research is it bringing forward?
That's why I say I would have never, ever in my life there to say we're going to cure addiction. Yeah. I think that we now have knowledge and tools that could potentially, definitively lead us to a cure of addiction.
Our guest today is the Institute's renowned director, Dr. Noura Volkoff, and we're talking to her at a time of unprecedented opportunities and challenges.
What has happened is whenever there is a change where you're going to have changes in priority, and in this case, there was also, we lost staff, and we didn't really know how that would ultimately affect our structure. And there's still several uncertainties of how it will go, but definitively things have settled, and the science is going really extremely well.
This is Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, Dr. Volkoff, welcome back to Conversations on Healthcare. You were with us 5 years ago.
Correct, before the COVID pandemic.
Before
thanks
the COVID.
For having me back.
Yeah, it's so great to see you. And we're here at Aspen Ideas Health, and we've been listening to some of your conversations that you've had with the larger group, and so informative. But rather focus a little in on what the Institute is doing now. What's your current focus in terms of research and your agenda going forward? I know earlier in the year, you said your blood pressure was a little high as the new administration came in. Have things settled down?
Yes, they have settled down. I mean, what has happened is whenever there is a change where you're going to have changes in priority, and in this case, there was also, we lost staff, and we didn't really know how that would ultimately affect our structure. And there's still several uncertainties of how it will go, but definitively things have settled, and the science is going really extremely well, which is ultimately the purpose of our existence. That's number one. The other issue that's very exciting, I want capital very, is the notion that we're seeing a significant decline in mortality from overdose.
Yes.
And that is very different from what we have been seeing for the past two decades, where everything is going up and up and up. Yeah. And since 2023, we're starting to see it go down. How much down? 26% in 1 year. Yeah. So it is large and consequential. So that's very, very exciting.
And why is it going down?
I think that the answer is multiple causes. It's not just one single one that is responsible for it. I would say that an important one has been a very aggressive campaign to distribute and make available the medications that we have to prevent people from overdosing, which are the medications for opioid use disorder. You treat people that are addicted to opioids with them, methadone, buprenorphine, naltrexone. But also we have a very effective medication that if you give naloxone, Narcan, if you give it when immediately after a person loses consciousness and stops breathing, you save their lives.
Right.
And there's no ill effects. The challenge is you have to do it rapidly and promptly. And the problem was that people would see someone overdosing, they didn't have the naloxone. So there was a very, very massive campaign to disseminate naloxone in situations and in places and for people that are likely high risk. And that has made a big, big difference.
Margaret, we heard the other day from
just thinking
governors.
The same thing. Yeah. Governor Sununu of New Hampshire quoted the difference, though, the great news about the reduction and the vast differences between rural and urban areas in the state that he formerly led. So we've made great progress, and this is one of those gaps to close, it seems.
Absolutely. And I'm glad that he has his eye on it because he's a very attentive person. And I think that the notion being that I'm telling you about this 26%, 27% decrease in overdose deaths, but it's not homogeneous. And there are areas where we're not seeing the decline. And that tends to be rural areas.
Right.
Why? Because it's much harder to bring treatment and medications and support to people there. But that means we need to tailor specific focus also into these areas.
Great. Well, on another note, the new director of NIH has publicly voiced his endorsement for your continued leadership at NIDA. And I would imagine that support is very important in your role. Tell us a little bit about how that plays out. You talked about having lost some staff. Are you feeling that you have the ranks to do the work, the scientists to do the work that you have as your agenda now?
Well, I mean, obviously, very much how much we can do, how fast we can do it is dependent on the resources that we have. So what our budgets will be will determine how much we can accelerate some of the projects that we have and which ones we may have to cut. Mm-hmm. There's no two ways around it. It is, for now, we have been able to continue the work that we are doing. And a very significant portion, for example, has been developed towards the expansion of this medication, creating models in healthcare, injustice settings, in communities. But we have also invested heavily on developing alternative treatments. Why? Because we only have three medications and not everybody responds. And the rate of discontinuation is very high. So we still have a lot of work to do there. And that's a major investment. And the other aspect on our portfolio is that of there are other drugs, not just opioids. And so, for example, we have cannabis consumption going up across the whole country. And we need to understand what are the consequences so people know if they're going to be using it, what they should be careful for. But also we have no treatment for cannabis addiction. We have no treatment for cocaine addiction. We have no treatment for methamphetamine addiction. So investments in that area. Yes. And the other one that I don't want to neglect ever again in my life is that of prevention. Because prevention is the most powerful intervention that we can do. And if we don't focus on it, some of you is, what could we have done differently to prevent the overdose crisis? What can we do differently for teenagers or young people to consume drugs that eventually may disrupt their lives or kill them? How do we do that? And that is the other element. So when you are asking me how important it is to have leadership supportive, extremely important. And so it's basically, it's not necessarily automatically because addiction is neglected. Mm-hmm. And there's discrimination of this disease is not as acceptable as cancer or Alzheimer's. So it's until very recently that we have had that endorsement that level of endorsement from leadership. So it is very, very, very heartening. And it also determines the ability to actually help push programs forward. Mm-hmm. So it is very important and we will determine what the budgets are. And we will readjust accordingly. That's why
it's
part of leadership.
You were talking about teenagers earlier. Substance abuse amongst adolescents is held sort of at a lower level, or where is it right now? I think a lot of parents listening to this today would appreciate knowing what the trend looks like.
Yeah, the trend looks very good from that perspective. Absolutely. It has been trending down and it continues to go down. And you know, we had a big decline during the COVID pandemic that is very likely explained by the fact that teenagers could not interact with one another and drug taking is a peer behavior. And there's a lot of peer pressure, actually, that leads people teenagers to consume drugs. So if you don't have that physical element, you are less likely to get exposed to drugs. So we were concerned that here comes, we've actually finally emerging out of the COVID pandemic. Society goes back to its previous normal, we will see a rise. Uh-huh. We didn't see it. The use of drugs are continued to go down. And including in this year, we saw a decline in marijuana consumption in 12th graders, which are kids that are 17 to 18 years of age. So the question is, what's going on? Why are we seeing a reduction, which is wonderful, in drug use on teenagers? And I'm going to speculate here because I think it is, but it's important that we understand. I think that there may be alternative reinforcers like I'm emphasizing how important it is drug taking initiation with other peers. And now teenagers rely a lot on social media and social communications through their cell phones.
Absolutely.
In many instances, much more than they would have been in the past in physical presence, that's one. So this may provide them also alternative reinforcers. So the power of these tools and apps to engage them may basically be distracting them from taking drugs.
Are you worried about social isolation as well in terms of that? On one hand, it may be helpful, but it seems like they're not engaging in group activities as much as they are one-on-one with their cell phones.
Certainly. And the issue has risen because, so everything has the positives and the negatives, mm-hmm. right? So what has been reported, and this basically has been traced around 2013 when the cell phone technology became much more widely right. available for teenagers, we see an increase in anxiety, an increase in depression, and we've seen an increase in suicidality. So this is an area, of course, of concern, and it has been voiced up because an important aspect of learning are social interactions. It's one of the main drivers of the complexity of our brains. We need to understand and act appropriately surrounding a wide variety of people. So that social interaction, which is so crucial to engage us and also for our well-being, if you isolate them, that's the question people are asking. Sure. Are you disrupting? And so we've actually, one of the things when I speak about prevention, we have been studying now for close to 8-9 years, teenagers that we recruited when they were 9 to 10 years old, 12,000. And we have been monitoring their brains every 2 years and their behavior every year. And then we've been monitoring, for example, how their uses of social media, mm-hmm. video gaming, just time on movies, or how much screen time they have, how many social, physical interactions they have, how their sleep, so their patterns of drug intake, their food, their exercise, to see how that affects the human brain. So now we have data using this big study, it's called ABCD, that actually has documented indeed that those teenagers that use social media in a compulsive pattern have much higher rates of anxiety, depression, and suicidal thinking. Hmm. So whereas those kids that use social media in a much more controlled fashion seem to be doing okay. And also an interesting finding that I do want to put forward is that it also documented that in those kids that were consuming many hours video gaming, interestingly, were better at certain cognitive process, specifically working memory, that requires that you basically keep in mind many things, and were faster, reaction times were faster. So just to illustrate that because our brain is changing so rapidly, they can have negative effects mm-hmm. if you don't learn to interact with others. Right. Right. But if you are basically spending all of these times to maximally coordinate all of these movements in three-dimensional space of these video games, maybe that improves the performance.
You've been talking about neuroplasticity, sort of how you might use that to the advantage of helping people deal with the desire for substance.
Correct. And I mean, that was in my brain is one of the things that's most exciting. I'm thinking in terms of how do we advance our ability to modulate neuroplasticity? How do we harness it? Neuroplasticity is ultimately what makes us learn things. And it can have very negative consequences, as I mentioned, because it can produce addiction. But neuroplasticity can also cure us from that addiction. So the issue is, how do we accelerate? How do we harness the ability of our own bodies to heal? But in this case, the ability of our own brain to restructure and reshape itself in a way that actually is more conducive to well-being mm-hmm. and protects you from taking drugs. Well, that's where I like to get the
science. This is so exciting because when we were here a year or two ago, Dr. Vivek Murthy was here speaking about the teens and the problem with social media and the addiction to that, and to have had a longitudinal study now with adolescents that we can really look at actual changes in the brain. Just kudos to NIDA and for that work. That's an incredible contribution.
Yeah, no, it's an incredible, incredible study. And actually, we provide the funding, we structure, we have the idea, we partner with the other institutes at the NIH. I was so successful that 3 years ago, I decided, okay, I'm going to be bold and I'm going to start one. But in infancy, right? Because we started to recruit 9 to 10. But a lot of things happened that first decade of life.
That's right.
So now we've recruited 3,000 pregnant women. Amazing. We're going to be following these infants. So if they cut our budgets, that's an issue when you're asking me,
But
it's what keeps me awake, is what increases my blood pressure. Because I've seen how consequential this ABCD study and again, not just for us in addiction, for psychiatry, for health conditions in general, like obesity, how it's affecting a child's brain to be obese. All of these patterns that are so important that we now have questions. We'll be able to get questions that relate to, we can right now, even fluoride content, we're obtaining teeth, we're obtaining biosamples of these children. So we have objective data.
Perfect. Wonderful. And, you know, if I can, before we go on, I want to just go back a little bit to the overdose fatalities in the country, because you have a big country that you're thinking about in doing this research. And the issue of the discrepancy in the rates, we talked about the age groups, for instance, and the decline in the adolescents. But the rates of death by overdose, I understand, are still way disproportionately higher for Blacks, Native Americans, and Native Alaskans. And I wonder if you could speak to that, and is there research underway to continue to try and tease that out, or what are your thoughts on that?
No, absolutely. And when you were asking me about the rural discrepancies, this is one of the main reasons, I mean, that puts the Native Americans at that horrific disadvantage, so many of them are in rural areas. Mm-hmm. So, and you have rates of overdoses that are double those of the general of the United States. So it's very, very high. And the same around Black Americans. What is also unique about Black Americans have 50% higher rates of overdose. So it's Native Americans that have the largest. Uh-huh. But differently, in Black Americans, we're seeing the overdoses, the highest difference with the other groups in older Black Americans. And that is a very unique, unusual demographic, because people after 50, 55 don't really seek out drugs. So there's something that's making them more vulnerable. So what are we doing? We target also a very large initiative to address, to allow actually the Native communities across the United States, we competed it, to do research that helps them understand what is the nature of the overdose crisis and the drug problems that they are seeing, but also what are the strengths that they have in their communities, and then use that to plan interventions, as opposed to someone else in another university someplace back flying in there and coming, you do this, which has never really sustained. So that is a project that's going on.
I want to get back to the issue of your blood pressure. You talked earlier about the anxiety of not knowing what's happening in Congress. We're taping this just before, hopefully, we're on the precipice of a resolution in Washington. But then you'll be left to deal with the financing that NIDA will receive. Maybe walk through for our listeners the internal process of how you make adjustments that might be coming your way. We hope none come your way. But in case they do, what's your internal thinking process, and how do you bring your team together around these issues?
Yeah, no, and we've actually started that whole process way before we know what the resolution is, because we have to have plan A, plan B, and plan C, obviously. And I think that in that decision of how we are going to reallocate fundings, because it's going to very likely mean that we're going to have to sacrifice certain projects, because we cannot just cut at the same level everything. That could jeopardize the ability to actually succeed. So how does one make that decision? Number one, in terms of urgency, we still have about more than 80,000 people dying from overdoses every year. And these overdoses are complex, because it's not just opioids, fentanyl, but it's also stimulant drugs like cocaine and methamphetamine. And we have nothing that actually serves as a medication for the treatment of cocaine or methamphetamine. So we need to accelerate that. There's no way that we are going to cut that research. It's still a major urgency. We're also seeing a significant rise in the consumption of cannabis across the United States, actually not by teenagers, but in the transition from teenagers to young adulthood, we're starting to see that rise. And we don't really completely understand what are the consequences. We know that some people have very adverse effects from the consumption of marijuana. The content of THC in marijuana has been going up, and the doses that people are consuming in any one given day are much higher. So that results in higher medical complications. We need to understand them. We have no treatment. So those are areas we cannot forego. And then the prevention side that is linked with the ABCD study that we were discussing and HPCD, those are also have been from the perspective of looking backward. What of the big projects that we funded has had some of the largest impact? I would say this is in the top. And it has served not just the addiction field, mental health, neurological, endocrinological diseases, just the development of children. Mm-hmm. And so we cannot sacrifice those two studies. So it's going to be a tricky situation. We get input, actually brainstorming. It's been very good to be hearing mm-hmm. ideas to get that perspective of where people are thinking, what they are going. And also, you know, an aspect that would be, I wouldn't like in any way to put us at a disadvantage. We're dealing right now, we're starting to glimpse just the beginning, and we are just, it's sort of putting us in awe of what we can do with large databases and uh-huh. how it can accelerate the development mm-hmm. of science and knowledge and treatments and opportunities. And so that whole field of building up data science, artificial intelligence, machine learning, that is a field that we cannot as a country nor as a field in addiction not be part of it, actively engaged on that. So those would be non-brainers. Uh-huh. The issue is the other projects are also meritorious, but we are going to have to determine with the input from the organizations.
Which of your children do you love most? And that's the problem that everybody faces yes. in doing that. Yeah. You keep on talking about there are no treatments. And yesterday we heard you talk about GLP-1 drugs. Is there any hope there? Anecdotally, we hear so many people talking about, well, it stopped my desire for eating and also I'm drinking less. And that may be anecdotal. What do you see out in the future and what needs to be researched with GLP drugs around addiction?
And now it's more than anecdotal because, and we have been funding research, as I mentioned, more than a decade ago in animal models. It stops them from drug taking, these GLP drugs. But there's also two randomized clinical trials in alcohol showing that people stop drinking, reduce their drinking behavior. We've been funding also studies for tobacco. Is reducing tobacco. The data, the clinical trials were not as large. So, and we're doing studies with opioid addiction, and we're doing studies with cannabis, and we're doing studies with cocaine and methamphetamine. It looks very promising. And so that is another aspect in terms of developing medications that right now, and I don't think I ever been as excited about the opportunities that we have. We have the GLPs, which also have already been given to humans. So if they show to be effective, we could bring them into the market relatively rapidly. But the other one are psychedelics. And I was speaking about the issue of mm-hmm. neuroplasticity. Right. So the whole concept is, are there drugs that we can use to open up those neuroplastic windows so that our brain changes faster? And we can do those changes within a context that you can do, for example, a cognitive intervention. Or you can use neuromodulation, which mm-hmm. is another aspect of technologies and tools that is very, very exciting and promising. So through it, you can fine-tune certain circuits and linkages that may be disrupted by addiction, for example, or strengthen those that you know are necessary for you to improve your ability to self-regulate desires and emotions. So if you think, and that's what I was trying to right. say with a big idea, combining these different elements and tools that we have. Mm-hmm. So that's where I can see the future into addiction. And that's why I say I would have never, ever in my life there to say we're going to cure addiction. Yeah. I think that we now have knowledge yeah. and tools that could potentially, definitively lead us to a cure of addiction.
That's great.
Well, we are so glad that people are hearing this message. We're here at Aspen Ideas, as you say, help. And the feedback from the scientists that have been presenting and the clinical scientists about the potential to actually address alcoholism and reduce mortality, obesity, food addiction, drugs, it's really very powerful. So thank you for that message. And I have to ask you, when you talked about your excitement about large data sets, we can hardly have a conversation without saying, and what is AI going to do for you in terms of the research that you're doing at NIDA, and is this going to really further your ability to get those large data sets and the information from around the country? Tell us what you're excited about
absolutely.
There.
Absolutely. And it can do
everything.
A lot of yeah. things. But if I have to pick up one, because I think that this is to me I mean, there are so many, but I'm going to be my nitty-gritty is curiosity. I've always been extremely interested on understanding how the human brain works. The human brain is extraordinarily complex, right? Billions of neurons, trillions of connections, circuits. I mean, every single part of the brain is connected. It's changing constantly. We need artificial intelligence to help us extract that information and to structure. And actually, that information extracted for how our brain has evolved over years and years and years of evolution can then be used to model artificial intelligence. So it's more intelligent. So that is where I would put the pinnacle of what artificial intelligence can do for all of us.
You know, I just want to give one plug for NIDA, and I'm going to date myself because back in 1972, the free clinic movement started, and we started as a free clinic. And the White House, at a large conference that we had, promised some money to support the work that free clinics were doing on substance abuse. In 1974, a young Dr. Robert DuPont took over NIDA and provided money for the National Free Clinic Movement to provide it. NIDA has always been a leading edge in our mind of important work, always at the forefront of trying to engage the public. So congratulations. I know last year was your 50th anniversary, but we continue to keep an eye on all the great work that you do.
Absolutely. And we want to thank you for taking the time to join us, Dr. Volkoff, for the incredible work that you're doing. And we also want to thank our audience for joining us for this most interesting conversation. And please remember to follow us on Facebook and X. Be sure to share your comments and your thoughts with us. We're always glad to hear from you. Thank you so much again, Dr. Volkoff.
Margaret, thanks very much. Thanks for having me here.
Yeah, it was an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Great.
This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.